This podcast will explore the intersection of self-identity, emotional intelligence, and global citizenship, addressing how to raise a generation of emotionally intelligent and globally aware individuals. It will feature conversations with educators, counselors, and thought leaders to provide actionable strategies, cultural insights, inspiration for parents, teachers, and anyone invested in the next generation. Grounded, growing, global. All right. Welcome to Roots and Wings. This is our very first podcast episode. I'm here with my lovely hosts, co-hosts, Casey Brubaker and Ashley Zomalt. And this is our episode one. And we are going to talk about who am I in the world? All right. And we're going to open this up with a prompting question or a guiding thought. And the question would be, who are you when no one is watching? All right, we're going to start it off with Casey. Who are you when no one is watching?
I love this question. And it is a question that is a journey for me right now, because I am working through who am I truly when nobody else is watching, because so much of my life has been defined by who I am when others are watching, what I am performing, what people expect of me, who I am as a daughter, as an athlete, as a student, and really losing part of who I am at my core because I was trying to be for others. And so one of the journeys that I'm on right now is looking at who I am if I'm not people pleasing. And it's been a really fun journey to be on at 44 years old, because you would have thought that somewhere I would have done that before we got here. But here we are, 44, living in a completely different country and on this journey. And so what I am discovering about myself is that there is a lot of learning, unlearning, and relearning that I get to do in regards to pulling out the things that I believe to be true about myself. I know that I am kind. I know that I am a giver. I know that I like to show up and be of service to others, but I know that I can no longer do that to the detriment of my own self and my own health. And so I'm learning how to navigate and negotiate who I am when the doors are closed, who I am when it's just me and my dog sitting here. And that's a really fun thing to do. And I would say that some of those central components of being kind, being a giver, being responsive, and being a helper in the world are still true. And at the same time, taking time to care for myself. And so that's the journey that I'm on. So I really love that question.
Nice. Very nice. I like that a lot. Yes, Ashley, go for it.
Okay. Can I also, before I respond, enter a mode of fellowship?
Sure.
Because Casey, I think a lot of what you said actually resonate. Like, it resonates with me. But also, I am so proud of you that you've been able to step into this place of relearning. Because as people, we kind of get stuck. And it's like, well, this is how I've always been doing things. And so this is just how I'm going to do it. I'm just going to keep sticking through it. And I think it can be more painful and a lot more work when we're older and we start recognizing things, but we're willing to shift and change so that we are a better version of ourselves. So I just want to make sure that you know that I heard that. And that it's very powerful that you're able to do that. So keep it up and let us know how your journey goes. And I like to think in visuals. So being a giver myself, I think of myself as a pie. And so if I'm giving away all my pieces to my pie, who is then refilling that pie plate? And who are those people around me that I need to keep close, that will make sure that I don't burn out and that I don't give all of myself up? So kudos to you. Keep it up. Great job.
Thank you, Ashley.
I love that.
That validation feels really good.
Yes, right? So I would say for myself, who am I when no one is watching? I can be a little more mean than I typically am, because I think there are parts of me throughout my day where that is not welcomed. And I enjoy and love all of me. And so there are parts of me that I let out when I know that I'm not going to be hurt, when I know that I'm not going to be judged, when I know that the people around me are going to just cherish every part of me, the good, bad, and the ugly. Behind closed doors, I yell at the top of my lungs. I sing to the top of my lungs. I dance like nobody's watching. I am always through and through in allowing these different parts of myself to service. There's still a core part of me that remains in all different sectors. And that is someone that loves fiercely, that is loyal. I have learned not to be blind in my loyalty. That is something that I have learned and has had to work on.
Sorry, pollen in Atlanta. So sorry.
And so when no one is watching, I'm goofy, I'm silly, usually beyond measure, because that's also one of my cores, because I love treating life just with humor and having fun. I've had a lot of pain in my life that I'm sure will be unveiled as we continue with our podcast. There's this quote from this researcher, Alan Cohen. It says, use pain as a stepping stone and not a campground. And that's always kind of stuck with me, because usually the nicest people in the world I have found have been to some of the more painful places in the world. When you use that as a stepping stone to grow and to pivot as a challenge versus this is my camping ground, this is where I live, this has become who I am, not helping me to become who I can be. I think when you differentiate between those two different camps of thought, you see that when you don't allow your past to be your end, when you allow your experiences to boost you forward, it can help define how you navigate things. Kind of like what Casey was saying, I'm a learner, but I'm also relearning things. And so taking these challenging moments in life, and I think when no one sees me, I feel comfortable and safe in expressing that pain and expressing, and more so reflecting on how to shift and use that challenge for my betterment.
That's amazing. You all are being very vulnerable right now. So who am I when no one is watching? I just turned 60, so I'm in a new decade, and I think who I am now is quite different than who I was when I was 20 or 30. I do realize that I am a master code switcher, that when I am in certain situations, I will adjust to the room, and I think that was a matter of survival, particularly in the workplace. I'm a teacher by training, and the kids would know when I was upset because my intonation and my language usage would change. I would go back into the comfort of being a little Black girl from the SWATs. And even though, you know, I did not grow up in the stereotypical realm of poverty, my mother went to Spelman in the 50s, you learn how to navigate in an all Black or all white or mixed environment. So I learned how to switch my tone when I was around my cousins, or, you know, when I was walking down the street in the neighborhood, even though, you know, the man across the street was a doctor and the other lady across the way was a principal. So I realize that I'm a master code switcher, but I'm also very authentic. And I've realized through life that being authentic, being me, being, and one of those things is being overly honest, has not always fared well in my existence. So I always try to be my authentic self, even when no one is when someone's watching, or either when no one is watching. And it reflects back on me. I have two grown children, and they will always tell me when they're telling me work stories, and I told her so and so, and I was very upset. And I was like, well, you know, maybe you need to pull back. And then they will throw in my face, you have always told us to be our authentic selves. And that's what I envy about this generation. They are their authentic selves in the workplace. We were taught to code switch. You're one way at home, you're one way at school, you're one way at church, you're one way at work. No, my pink hair, long fingernail, Chanel red lipstick wearing youngest child goes to work just like that. She does not code switch. And I don't think they realize that they don't have to code switch because they were brought up in an atmosphere where, you see what I'm saying? They were brought up very middle, upper middle class. I'm not going to even candy coat it. So that is how they talk. That is their being. But they have this whole little sassiness to them that, you know, Black culture is Black culture, Hispanic culture. They have a plethora of friends, Jewish, Hispanic, and they are who they are. So they throw back up in my face that I should always be who I am, no matter where I am. And I've embraced that. At 60. At 20 and 30, you know, I just had a whole conversation with my girlfriend at lunch yesterday. We were talking about, we grew up in the 80s and we were wearing button-up shirts and long pants and loafers. We were covering it up. And we were like, why on earth were we covering up the best bodies we've ever? It's a horrible time to be a young person because we're just like all buttoned up in the preppy phrase. So I know that I have switched and adjusted based on the atmosphere in which I existed. And at 60 years old, I've decided that's no longer an option. Authenticity is real. So I think, I talk, and I play the way I play, even when I'm around people or not around people. And I've learned to lean into the discomfort of it because some people don't like authentic people because they're not being authentic and it makes them nervous. So that's who I am when no one is watching. I hope that made sense. I felt like that was going on.
Did make sense. And I feel like it, I would love to also follow your journey in this kind of being your authentic self. Because as I said before, there are just parts of me that I am comfortable with the world having access to. And there are parts of me that I don't, and I don't necessarily know entirely if that is a problem or a struggle, because I believe that there are people that don't deserve all of me.
Well.
And so there are parts, I think, of my Taurus coming out. There are parts of me that like to observe. And so when I am around people, sometimes like, oh, she's, you know, quiet. She's a little reserved. And I'm like, no, I'm watching you. Because I want to know what parts of me you deserve. What parts am I actually going to let out?
You know, Ashley, I had to get comfortable with the fact that my partner now says that about me. He brings that part out. He's my ex-husband, but that's a whole nother podcast. But he says that either people love me or they hate me.
Yeah.
And I had to be comfortable. I had to get comfortable with that. So what resonated with me when you were saying that is particularly at work is my example.
Yeah.
And either they loved me or they hated me. And when I realized they hated me, I in my brain, I'm sitting there looking at them going, oh, you don't like me. But you know what? I'm not going to stop being me. I'm not going to stop pushing this forward. I had to be comfortable with the fact that they did not like me. And I actually believe I learned that skill growing up in the South. My grandmother used to say, it is better to know that they wear their hoods in public than in private.
Yeah.
And so when I knew where we were in this spectrum, where we landed, I knew how to deal with you then. You don't like me, but we're in this space together and we have to function. And I think I learned that at a early age. And I think that's what pushed my authenticity, that I was okay with someone not liking me.
Interesting.
Because I probably didn't like them.
Yeah. And My growing up, I'm the youngest, I'm the baby, and that might have some drive to this as well. But my sisters would always tell me, you're so strong, like you just don't care. Because at the end of the day, I actually don't. I spend a lot of time with myself. I'm not sure how much of that is normal, but I really do enjoy myself. My husband loves my quirkiness. He loves the way that I laugh at myself. I'm a close friend to myself. I really do believe that. So when people are acting a certain way, I'm not sure that that's my drive. But I look at it more as energy. And I don't want to give out a lot of energy when you don't deserve that. if I'm going to give 100% of myself, it's going to be to a select few. Mm-hmm. And I think that's mainly for, I can't be there for everyone. And I can't show up the way that I do for my close-knit circle. I can't show up for them if I'm showing up for everybody else. And right. There's different like layers to that and levels to that. And I think for me, I don't care about the judgments that people have because they don't know me. I just don't want to put forth that effort because you exist. Yeah. If that makes sense. I'm going to be kind and cordial. That is my core. See a need, feel a need. But everyone's not going to like you. They're not going to love you. They're not for you. Some people have a season in your life. And I think for those seasonal people, and for some people that might not even have a season, I'm just kind of like, here's the package that you get. And right. then, you know, you can have a retirement party if you...
That's very funny.
You last a little bit longer.
Well, that's actually a good segue because we started talking about our early experiences. Ashley said that she's the youngest. So we're going to jump to Casey, and I want you to tell us what a defining childhood experience that shaped your identity.
That's a really, man, Patrice, all these good questions you're throwing out. So I would say one of the defining situations, one of the defining things that happened was I was a gymnast as a child. And I remember, I have a vivid memory of being on the balance beam. And I had to throw a back handspring. And I was, I don't know, maybe 8, 9 years old. And I was terrified of the beam. It was my least favorite. And I remember my coaches and my parents just waiting there. And they said, you have the potential. You have to decide if you're going to use it. And we waited in that gym for an hour for me to do it because they would not back down. And it was just a couple things that it taught me. One, people believe in me and they're going to stick with me until I do it. Two, I have to believe in myself. Nobody else is going to get up here and do this skill for me because I couldn't. I had to do it for myself. And in addition to that, there was always a resounding voice, whether it was from my parents or my coaches or my teachers, that said, you have so much potential. And sometimes that motivated me. And sometimes it crippled me because it made me wonder, do I have all this potential that I can't tap into? Or is my identity the resilient person who keeps working towards that? And so that's just one thing that plays out again and again in my life. Am I resilient or am I crippled by the fear of this or anything like that? And so I think that has been a part of my identity that has swung in different directions at different times, depending on the situation. So that's just one small childhood experience that I think about. I think the other thing that comes to mind a lot is we were a big Peter, Paul, and Mary family. And so I remember going to a Peter, Paul, and Mary concert as a young child. But more so than that, I remember the lyrics that my parents used to always sing. And they were lyrics of resistance and just a lot of peace-loving, bra-burning, like 1970s protesting war songs. And that was sort of what I grew up with. But it was more than just the lyrics. It was what do we do with that? And how do we show up for other people? And where do we show up to do our part in the world? And so those were two strong memories that I had as a child.
Nice.
Wow.
You know, athletes are a different breed. Like, sit for an hour, I would have left. I'm just not that person.
Listen, in my 9-year-old brain, it was an hour. It could have been like 20 minutes, but it was a long time.
Yes.
It was a long time. And I remember just standing there and going back and forth, like as if I was going to go and not going. Anyway,
competing at a young age, it puts something in people that's quite different. I'm always in awe with athletes, the level of discipline that it takes. Ashley?
Can you repeat the question for me?
Sure, I can repeat the question. What's a defining childhood experience that shaped your identity?
That's hard.
No.
Yeah, that's really hard because there's just so many. But I'm gonna use my core values as a way to help guide the conversation. My mother and father were very into family, but above all, they were very into who you are as an individual and how you show up. Lived in a city where Black people were not the predominant number. I went to a private Christian school from preschool to eighth grade. There were many times because I did not have mirror image of peers, teachers, influential members directly around me that impacted my self-esteem. It never impacted my drive in terms of intrinsic motivation to be the best at what I was doing. In fact, my parents, which I do know how, and I also don't know how, co-signed my idea that I wanted to play every sport known to man. And so every 2 years I would switch to a new sport.
Hilarious.
And then they were just, my mother would be that mirror for me because she saw how I was impacted by conversations that I couldn't relate to with, you know, the top down and the wind in my hair. My hair is blowing. And I'd be like, what's that? My hair doesn't do that. And it wasn't until high school when I moved to Long Beach, California. And I was around very many people that looked like me, that I had realized how much I had internalized from experiences that I had around people that didn't look like me, to the point where when people would tell me, oh, I really like your hair, I had never had those types of compliments. So I had always branded my hair as ugly. My skin color, I didn't realize in the Black communities, it's considered on the lighter, fairer side. I didn't know that I was in that package label. I really thought my skin is really dark, which I now am wishing I had that chocolate thunder.
No, you said chocolate thunder.
But I say all that to say it had created a very different self-image of who I was. And I remember my mom would take pictures. My dad would take pictures. I was not a fan of pictures because I didn't like what was being reflected back to me. Then I remember my mother would take me into the bathroom, and this is my core memory, and she would have me stand in front of the mirror, and she would tell me all of the things that she loved about me physically and characteristically. And she would tell me all of these things that were unique and true to only me. There were things about myself I hadn't even seen or noticed. I'm going to get emotional.
Because that's an amazing story.
Yeah, that's really powerful.
I didn't know. And I wish that I could go back in those moments and tell that little girl how beautiful and amazing and intelligent and fierce she was, because she didn't know. And, you know, my mom would say things like, your eyes have this almond shape. And I would be like, what? I would look in the mirror like, oh my gosh, they do. There were all of these things that she knew about me that I was such in a, kind of back to that quote I named before, my pain was a campground. And so my experience when I moved to Long Beach, being around all of these beautiful people, because it's very diverse there. It's one of my most favorite places to be. It was a healing place. And I could actually see myself and I was happy and I was like, I'm not wasting any more time.
Right.
This face is going to get shown. This hair is going to be worn down. All of these things. And I now impart that same encouragement and wisdom onto students that I've had that are at these PWIs who are having these moments. I'm encouraging their parents, their caregivers, their families to just love on them, surround them, remind them who they are. And I do the same for my children. And I'm just so glad that I had a mom who was just that amazing, that knew what needed to happen and made it happen.
That's a great story. Thank you for sharing. That is amazing. So I guess I have to ask myself the question, defining moment. I speak of my mother a lot because my father died when I was 5 and he died behind me. I was watching television back in the 60s and 70s, young people. Cartoons came on during primetime at night. We were watching Roadrunner, and he would always root for the coyote. But anyway, so my father was an alcoholic. It's something that we never really talked about in my family, and nor was it said aloud that he died from alcohol poisoning that night. And I remember when he hit the ground, and I ran, and I hid behind the sofa, and that happened, and that was traumatic. I remember the ambulance ride, and I was 5. But the defining moment is when I returned back to school in this very close-knit community in Southwest Atlanta. We walked to school. We all lived next door to each other. I love community schools. I think I just wrote a blog about it. I think we should go back to that concept, but I know we have to even out the funds. But the defining moment came when I went back to school. And I think the kids have been prepared. I imagine that was pretty traumatic for partners to learn that their friend's dad died suddenly. So I think people had conversations. I know they had. And obviously my mother prepared me to go back because I went into the office and they walked me down. And Miss Bell was my teacher. Love her. Oh my God, she was the best teacher ever. She guided me into the room by my shoulders. And I'm standing in front of the room like, you know, it's going to be a party. I miss school. I love school. I missed it. I was back. And Corsetta Sims. Yes, I said her whole name. She looked up and said, she doesn't have a daddy. And I don't remember my response. But I remember I didn't cry or I was not angry. So clearly my mother had prepped me for this moment that someone was going to say something ugly. But I go ahead 50 some odd years and I met Pamela Shannon, Dr. Pamela Shannon. She's a doctor now that was in that classroom that day. We've been going to school with each other since we were kindergarten. We went to Spelman together and we were at a luncheon. It was a random luncheon that we ended up together. And she brought that story back to me. And she was explaining to the person sitting at the lunch table with us that I've never seen someone experience or express or navigate a situation with such grace. She was 5. I was 5. And she remembered that moment that I did not yell. I did not get angry. I mean, Miss Bell corrected the little girl, but she remembered that moment. And she said, I never forgot how well you handled that moment. And I'm like, girl, we were 5. So I realized in that moment that there was a world outside of my family. I realized in that moment that the way people see you matters. The way people see your family unit matters. And I probably started to navigate life or understand the premise of life based on there's you and your family. And yes, you can be your authentic self and you can be whoever, but the way people see you is quite important. And she tried to lessen me in that moment. And I had to learn that. So I figured out that people trying to lessen you should not stop you from doing anything. So I became extraordinary, actually. I mean, I'm always doing the most. I was first chair of Viola. You know, I got great grades. I was a reader. I did everything because I didn't want her to think that I was less. That one person in that moment, I was less just because my father died. And it came up later in life about my father dying. Like, we had nothing to do with the fact that he died. I mean, there was no control in that process, but people value that family unit and how you appear to people on the outside that determine how they make judgments about you. So it was a pretty defining moment for me. And I know when we first started talking about this, we talked about a television show. When we started this process, we were scripting it. And that's why I think I like Bewitch, because she spent most of the day being a witch, but then when she would go out in society with her husband, she had to hide the fact. So she had to pretend. So she was one way at home and another way out in the world, because it mattered to him, because he was up and coming in corporate America, and how could he be married to a witch? It was actually quite profound. She might as well have been a Black woman, because he was hiding her and she was pretending to be something that she was not. So very early on, I understood that society, unfortunately, has great influence upon who you choose to present and be in the world.
Yeah.
So yeah, Corsetta Sims, she has no idea.
She might listen to this one day and be like, be like,
I had
goodness.
No idea.
She has no idea how she shaped my identity.
Yeah. Mm. Patrice, one of the things that I think is really powerful as I was listening to you talk about that, you were talking about, and I can't remember, Pamela Shannon watched you and observed how you responded in that moment. And earlier you were talking about showing up authentically and how you've done that and how you have grown into that. Part of it has always been there, but at different parts of your life, professionally or wherever, you've really intentionally done that. And I think that that's one of, you know, and you said some people either love or hate you. And I think that there's another component there, that those of us who have a hard time sometimes showing up authentically in the world because of what other people might perceive, or with me, it's this people pleasing idea, right? When people like the two of you show up so authentically in a space, it really is motivating and it really is inspiring, and it gives people almost like the permission to say, can I do that? Mm. I can't do it in the same way, because then it wouldn't be authentic to me. But if Patrice can do it, if Ashley can do it, then I might believe that I can do it. And Ashley, you have this shirt that I used to love. And maybe you still wear it, but I don't see you every day anymore. But it said, know your worth and add tax.
Yes.
Do you remember that shirt?
Yes.
I love that shirt. And every time you showed up in that shirt, I was like, damn it, something I can't do, but Ashley can, and I'm going to honor that, and I'm going to value it, and I'm going to love it. And that, to me, when you, Patrice, show up fully authentically, and Ashley, you show up in that shirt and you don't even say anything, but you walk into a room with it, to me, that really is inspirational. And one of the things that I just want for the two of you to know is that there are other people like me out there that take inspiration from the two of you. So don't stop being authentic, because it's really powerful. So thank you.
Thank you for that.
A little circle there.
That was great. A good t-shirt says it all. When I used to work at a PWI, every February 1st, I would wear a shirt that says I'm Black every month.
Yes.
It would piss people off.
But when you show up like that, it's so important.
It's so important.
I wouldn't even bring attention to it. I would just wear it.
Yes.
And act like I didn't even have it on.
And you know what interests me about that? And something that I myself have thought about over the years. There's something about being Black and celebrating your love for being Black that is intimidating, that is not shared with other communities. If I were to show up in a space and, you know, let's say I'm preserving my culture, and I, you know, there are cultures out there with arranged marriages and celebrations and things that they do. And if they show up and say, I need a space, it does not, I don't think there's not that same response of just pure, I'm jumping to a place where this represents something I should be uncomfortable with. And I'm not sure that y'all have had the same observations, but I thought of that because, you know, if I show up and I say, I'm celebrating this holiday or this, you know, I'm a woman every month, there's not the same response of like, it's almost as though acknowledging your love for being Black is seen as like a weapon. And the response is usually like, I'm uncomfortable. Like, I can't, I don't want to say anything. I don't want to do anything. But my body language and my behaviors are saying a lot, very loud.
Wow. Let's talk a little bit about social emotional growth and how that's impacted by our experiences that we've shared, childhood experiences that we've shared. And I think we've talked about it a little bit, but let's zone in a little bit more on that. How can cultural expectations clash with your personal identity? Why are you smiling like that, Ashley?
I feel like as we've been talking, a lot of that theme has shown up. Mm-hmm. Earlier, Patrice, you were saying that you're an excellent code switcher. Mm-hmm. But I feel like I can speak as being a Black woman in America. I feel like that you have to have that to survive. You have to have that ability. I think when I enter spaces, even if it's a classroom setting, there are a lot of things that I know how to do and didn't have a name for it until I was in education. And a teacher came up to me and was like, wow, like you really were switching so well. And I was like, what are you talking about? She was like, oh, you know, you'd be teaching and then you'd be like, wait, something's going on. I need to switch over and acknowledge what she said, address it, and then we're going to move forward. And I was like, well, yeah, but that's like an everyday thing. Like, you don't do that like every day. And so, of course, that shapes how I interact with people, but also back to what you were saying in terms of wanting to be more authentic. I think if I were more authentic, I would pull into the parking lot with my speakers blasting with my favorite song. But when I get into certain neighborhoods, I make sure to turn the music down. And I feel like everything that I do in that regard with those decisions is for the comfort of others, but never highlighting my comfort. And understanding that and working in certain settings, but also just being who I am. That's how I function. That's how I express myself. I wrote a paper in college about how music embraces the soul. Because that is how I get my emotions out. And so then I have to kind of hold that in until I can be behind a door when no one's watching and scream out lyrics to the top of my lungs and enjoy things.
Right.
And I say all that to say, with the question, how does our culture define our identity? I think when you live in a world that tells you to be ashamed of who you are, when you live in a world that says, you know, that's not dignified. These things that as a people we have created responses to help us are viewed as ghetto or unrefined, then creates these gaps in our identity and how I can show up in a way where I'm still respected. I pull up to the boardroom and I'm bumping my music with my Beats because I do have speakers in my car. I am from Los Angeles. I did used to ride up and down the Shaw. Am I still going to have that same respect entering the boardroom and expressing myself?
Right.
And those are the types of things that are always at the forefront of my mind, is more so how will this be perceived and how will this harm me down the line? Kind of talking about cause and effect. If I'm in a space where I want to grow, how do I get there? How do I negotiate my salary? If I come in and you see I have a shirt that says I'm Black every month, will you respect that? Will you appreciate that?
That was probably put on my list. Things Patrice has done to offend us.
And, you know, it's sad, but those are the types of things that you have to stop and think about before you just can go out.
Right.
I can't just grab these t-shirts and just go. Or you actually made me think of your I Am Black every month when I was in college, which was a PWI. I wore an afro for the first time in my life. And I also had a bit of a body, so I had a little midriff top on, a little tummy was out. And I just remember all of the stares I was getting. And I couldn't figure out if it was because I had a midriff top on, because that's actually not Ashley. I think I started wearing dresses when I got to college. Like, I've always been pants, top, let's go. Or if it was the afro. So I changed my clothes, came out, was still getting the same stops and looks and stares and whispers. And I realized in that moment, I said, oh my gosh, people are responding to my afro. Like, they can't respond well to this, because the looks were not, oh my gosh, this is so amazing. Those looks were, what is going on? Who is this? What is she doing? And I was not insecure about my afro. I loved it. It was beautiful. And so I wore it for a whole week, because I was like, I was just doing this right now because I hadn't washed my hair and I still had some chlorine in there from the swimming pool.
That is funny.
But I say all that to say that culturally, mm-hmm. you know, my parents were always, you got to work twice as hard. You've got to do what you need to do. Keep your head down. My mother was always like, you're not only Black, you're a Black woman. In America, you've got two strikes against yourself. Don't get a third. And that's sad to have to think of living day to day with your head down.
It's limiting.
Noise so that you can make it through to the next day.
Casey, have you ever felt limited based on cultural expectation?
I would say yes, definitely. As I look at you two and listen to your stories, not in the same ways, right? And or definitely not to the extent. One of the things before I answer that question, because it's important that I weigh in about my own experiences. But one of the things that I was thinking as Ashley was speaking, you had also asked Patrice about how does that influence where we are socially, emotionally, where we are in regards to our own mental, social, emotional wellness, right? And one of the things that I think is so important that we have to pay attention to as a society, especially with our young ones, is when these messages are put upon us, what does that do for us internally? Mm-hmm. And Ashley, I can't speak for you, but I was pairing what you were saying about what the world was telling you with what your mom was telling you. And if you might not have had your mom's voice and, you know, her words and her affirmation and her right. belief in you, then what the world is putting on us can be so heavy that it impacts our self-worth and makes us believe that we are not worthy. We are not valuable. We do not have a place in this world. And that can bring about all kinds of different mental health challenges, whether it be anxiety or depression or just this whole unknowing mm-hmm. of our own worth. And yeah. then that can also build anger and resentment and all kinds of different things. And so I think that's the really, really important piece of us as adults in the world. What is the messaging that we are constantly giving to young people?
Right.
So Patrice, you started by talking about your daughters and how they're always now reflecting back to you. I'm sorry. Children.
No, it's
you
okay.
spoke specifically about your daughter with the pink hair,
Sydney.
Right?
Yes.
Okay, sorry. And you have a son too.
Yes, Taylor.
Okay, I apologize.
No, worse.
Your children. And so how they're reflecting back to you to be fully authentic because they were taught their value when they were young, and how important that is that we give that to young people in our words, in our actions, where we interfere and interrupt if others are not doing that. And I'm thinking, you know, in the school in which I am in, the ways that that does and doesn't happen, and in my role specifically, ways that I can step more into that. So that was just a little pause and a break to uh-huh. hit on that social, emotional, mental health piece and the importance of that. When I think about some experiences with me when I was younger. I think that a lot of the times where people had sort of vocalized to me that I wasn't good enough or I wasn't, they didn't approve of my identity in certain ways, probably all revolved around being a girl and whether or not I was good enough, fast enough, strong enough, whatever, as a girl. And I think I took that as a personal challenge to prove to every single boy that I interacted with that, yes, I am stronger than you. Yes, I am faster than you. And luckily, I was an athlete. And so luckily, being a gymnast, I was arm wrestling boys in eighth grade and I was winning. Now, I guarantee you by ninth grade, when they started weightlifting for football in high school, I was no longer winning. But it was really like a challenge for me to prove. Now, I think that's a really important difference because sometimes when we are faced with an obstacle, we are a challenge, right? We can see it in two different ways. This is an obstacle and I can't overcome it and I'm going to stop and I'm going to accept my fate in the world as this girl who's not as strong as the boys. Or I can accept it as a challenge and watch me disprove you and watch me show you my worth. And so I think that's another thing, you know, when we talk a lot of catchphrases with growth mindset and resiliency, and we use that language a lot, but it is important language to use that we are teaching all of our kids. You can overcome things that are set in your way. And if we see this as a challenge to be conquered, how exciting is that versus an obstacle that has been put in our way and we can't do anything about it? So I think I was lucky to have parents who really taught me that I could overcome anything that I wanted to. So that's where
Ashley,
I
want to add to that, because now we need to talk about takeaways. Like, what can we leave our listeners with to help children thrive in a world that sometimes gives them conflicting things and experiences that cause inner conflict and a sense of self-worth?
So I think this is a great time because you have a great way of closing loops.
Yes, she does.
What I will say is kind of what I mentioned before. As a parent, it is very important that you instill what your family values are into your children. It is very important that you remind your children who they are, that you remind them of all the things that you love about them, and that we constantly, at the same time, are willing to trust that our children can overcome obstacles. I think that's the way that we back up what we're saying. To say it is one thing, to show that you believe it is another. And I want to say that when our kids hurt, it's hard as parents to not step in and to not take over. And what I find is the more that we can kind of teach at home and release and allow our children, our students, our clients to literally practice living life, practice putting into play and applying what we're teaching them, it makes them more confident and more capable.
Right. So we're going to wrap it up. I'm going to end with a quote. Roots keep you grounded. Wings take you forward. True growth is knowing when to stand firm and when to fly. We encourage you to reflect upon our very first question. Who am I in the world? And particularly, who am I when no one is watching? Thank you for watching and have a great day.